From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscow-Wain, sitting in for Terry Gross. Reverend Wanda Henry Jenkins helps families deal with violent death at the worst possible moment when they arrive at the morgue to identify the body of their loved one. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Wanda Henry Jenkins about the bereavement program she founded at the Philadelphia Medical Examiner's Office. Also, we meet novelist Michael Chabon. His new book is called Wonder Boys. Chabon's first novel, The Mysteries of Pittsburgh, was written for his master's thesis but became a best-selling novel. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews The Romantic Generation, a new recording by pianist Charles Rosen. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton is meeting with Defense Secretary William Perry today to discuss recommendations on closing military bases. UPI's Bill Small has this report.
A White House spokeswoman describes the meeting between Mr. Clinton and Defense Secretary Perry as a briefing and not a meeting at which a decision would be made on whether to approve a compromise plan worked out between the Pentagon and the independent commission charged with recommending military bases to be closed. Mr. Clinton's under considerable political pressure from California, a state heavy in electoral votes, to reject the commission's recommendations to close six bases in California, including McClellan Air Force Base near Sacramento, a move that could cost nearly 27,000 military and civilian jobs. Mr. Clinton has until the 15th to ask the commission to reconsider its recommendations. The final say, however, is up to Congress. Bill Small at the White House.
Federal Reserve policymakers are meeting in Washington today and tomorrow. They may decide the fate of interest rates. There's been increasing evidence that the economy is slowing down, but several analysts believe the central bankers will leave current interest rates alone. A few analysts are arguing that the economy is sinking and demands an immediate rate cut. The Fed had been hoping to slow down the economy with several rate increases over the last year, but there's worry the economy could slow down much too quickly. Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin is worried about upcoming congressional hearings on the raid on the Branch Davidian compound in Waco, Texas. Rubin gave a letter to journalists that said he fears the hearings may be used to attack federal law enforcement officers and gun control laws. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
The House Judiciary and Government Reform and Oversight Committees have tentatively scheduled Waco hearings for July 19th. The 1993 standoff ended in a raid by federal agents. 80 people died when the compound erupted in fire. Authorities believe the fire was set by the cult members. Secretary Rubin's letter acknowledges that mistakes were made in the field at Waco and in Washington by federal supervisors, but it says the Waco raid cannot be properly understood outside the context of Oklahoma City. Rubin is worried that investigating events at Waco without investigating the extreme activities of some militias seems to suggest that law enforcement agencies are the real threat to the safety of American citizens. A Senate panel recently held a hearing on the militia movement. So far, none is scheduled in the House. I'm Peter Kenyon in Washington.
The Oklahoma grand jury investigating the bombing of the federal building will reportedly hear today from a friend of bombing suspect Timothy McVeigh. The Dallas Morning News says James Rosencrans of Kingman, Arizona, goes before the jurors to talk about how he got three guns from McVeigh's army buddy, Michael Fortier. Rosencrans has told the paper he's been questioned several times about the guns by FBI agents. He says he had no idea the guns he bought may have been stolen in a plot to finance the bombing, as officials suspect. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 34 points at 46.19. This is NPR. Two leaders of the former commune of Bhagwan Shri Rajneesh are on trial in Oregon for an alleged 1985 plot to murder a U.S. attorney. From Oregon Public Broadcasting, Lee Garnett reports.
This trial was delayed by a four-year deportation fight to get Sally Ann Croft and Susan Hagen from Great Britain, where they moved after the Rajneesh commune in Oregon collapsed. In opening arguments, prosecutors said the two women organized a murder conspiracy against former U.S. Attorney Charles Turner, who was threatening the commune with his investigation of illegal immigration. The alleged plot failed, and Turner is expected to be a key prosecution witness in the trial. It was Turner's probe that led to the conviction and deportation of Bhagwan Shri Rajneesh in 1985. The commune attracted international attention in the 4 years that it thrived in central Oregon on a 64,000-acre ranch. For National Public Radio, I'm Lee Garnett in Portland, Oregon.
Senator Jesse Helms wants to cut back government spending for AIDS. The North Carolina Republican is quoted by the New York Times as saying people get AIDS because of their own, quote, deliberate, disgusting, revolting conduct. The Senate is considering whether to renew a federal program for care and treatment of AIDS patients. Helms says AIDS is only the ninth leading cause of death in the United States, but the disease gets more federal funding than diseases that kill more people. The Times reports government figures don't back up his claim. The Centers for Disease Control says AIDS is the leading cause of death among people aged 25 to 44. A report finds that mutual fund investors are doing very well this year. Lipper Analytical Services says the average stock fund is up 16% for the first half of this year, 8% in the second quarter, which has just ended. Technology funds have done the best. They're up an average of 17% in the second quarter of this year. They have jumped 25% in 1995. Lipper surveyed nearly 2,000 funds. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Every time there's a homicide, a family is murdered too. According to the FBI, more than 24,000 people were murdered nationwide in 1993, which means that many more thousand had to deal with the shock of the event, as well as law enforcement, the criminal justice system, the press, and the medical community. For while death is an everyday occurrence, murder is a public event, which makes bereavement for the family that much more difficult. Wanda Henry Jenkins' mother was murdered in 1972 on her way home from the hospital in Chicago where she worked as a nurse. After many years of upset and soul-searching, Henry Jenkins decided to help other families of murder victims. She is the founder and executive director of the Grief Assistance Program, which is housed at the Philadelphia Medical Examiner's Office. The organization assists families grieve their loss and helps them navigate the various systems and agencies that are involved with homicide. Like many who are in crisis after learning that a family member has been murdered, Wanda Henry Jenkins said that she and her family went through the motions of mourning their mother's death without feeling much relief.
I think we kind of all went into denial, not denial about her death. The death, we accepted. The murder, we used all the same words that other people use, passed on, died, and things like that. And we all kind of sat around like people do around death in that first week. And you just kind of laugh and joke and talk about what the person did and what they would or wouldn't expect you to do. Because my mother was a pretty clear, level-headed person who had prepared us for dying and for what to do when she died. So we knew what to do, and my father was around. We all knew what to do, and we did what we were supposed to do. But what was complicating it was the presence of the police, the news media. It was on TV so much. I mean, it was all day, every day for almost 3 weeks. Because she was a nurse at a major hospital, Northwestern Memorial, and she had just left work. So, you know, the police are the one who notified the hospital when they went to investigate. So it was just so much interference in the normal bereavement process. You don't get things done like normal. And when I say that, for instance, you couldn't just call the funeral director and say so-and-so died. Come and pick up the body or go to the hospital and pick up the body. You had to wait until the coroner, until the medical examiner called you and said, now you can come identify the body.
So there are all these external factors that really do impede then whatever kind of grieving.
Yeah, even
you
at the hospital. Because number one, they took her in there and here's this nurse. The nurses can see this is a nurse with her name tag on, you know, Ms. Juanita Henry, you know, LPN. And they're freaked out. They really are. And they're trying to work on this dead woman because she's a nurse. And they imagine that they could have left home work and the same thing could happen. And what tends to happen is people become very distant at that point. They don't want to deal with it. And therefore, they're not very nice to the family. And when my father, he left, they called him at work. He left work because he worked midnight to 8 at Loyola University. He left work. He picked up my sister, went to the hospital. And when they walked in to ask about her, they said, the corpse is in the room.
Just like that.
He didn't even know she was dead. They did not know she was dead. And instead of saying, well, come over here, Mr. Henry and the daughter, and talk to them and let them know that she didn't make it, they just said, the corpse is in the room.
Her murder was never solved.
Never.
Does that mean there was a period in which the grief that you had for her death was also unsolved or unresolved?
Yeah, definitely unresolved, because it was like, you know, you have this hole in your heart. and someone's saying heal, but you still have a hole in your heart. Nothing has been done to it. And so it was like a shadow, really, a shadow in the background that was always there, always there. You have a sadness and you don't know why you have a sadness, a pain and you don't know why you're hurting. And it just doesn't make sense. But you know one thing for certain, and that is that your lifestyle is changing, and not necessarily for the good.
Well, how did your lifestyle change, and how were you able even to pick up the pieces after her death?
Well, the first few years, I was so busy helping my father to raise my sisters and brothers, I didn't have a lot of opportunities to really think about it. I was very involved in the church and community, but what I didn't realize is that I'd stopped going out, I'd stopped dancing, I'd stopped playing volleyball, and I was gaining weight. And
you think all those things were connected with
her homicide? Oh, I know they were
homicide.
Connected, because she came home at night and was murdered. And I remember working at night, 11 to 7, and when I would walk to work, you know, you look behind yourself, constantly kind of vigilant, about your environment, about the people around you, and things like that. And I always lived in a security building, you know. Things that I felt, I guess subconsciously, I was safety connected, because when a parent is killed, what happens is that the child loses their source of protection. You know, it's different. So I did things like that.
So when did you begin your work dealing with other families who also had lost family members to murder?
Well, actually, I would say it began in college, in that when someone would lose someone to death, I would just reach out to them. You know, especially if they lost a mother or a father or someone like that. And I would, you know, I didn't try to compare our experiences. I simply said, hey, I'm here if you want to talk. And I began to write about it and began to deal with it. And then when I graduated, well, the last year of college, my last 6 months, it was a good thing I had a good GPA, because that's when I seriously mourned my mother's death. I had become sensitive enough and open enough to the pain to realize that the only way I was going to work through this was to work through it.
And how'd you do that?
I had to do it. I wrote those journals. I found someone that I could talk to about it. I cried. I acknowledged my pain. I trusted God enough to say, your shoulders are big enough to handle what I'm going through. And I didn't feel like, because I was a minister, I had to pretend that I was okay. I wasn't okay. At least my heart wasn't okay. And so I dealt with it, and I talked to a psychologist and a minister, and I worked through it.
Well, let me reintroduce you, and our guest is Reverend Wanda Henry Jenkins. She's the founder and executive director of the Grief Assistance Program, which is headquartered at the Philadelphia Medical Examiner's Office. And we're talking about what happened to her back in 1972, having to deal with her mother's death. And that really gets us to the kind of work that you do today. Your office is in the city morgue. Mm-hmm. Why did you choose that particular location?
Well, over the years... When I said I had worked through this grief, this is 1979 now, 7 years later, and I'm finally over that hurdle, realizing the peace has come and I'm okay. I really began to wonder, well, okay, what did I go through? Mm-hmm. Was there a process of what I went through? And was it unique? Did other people who experienced this loss have this? And I began to search out others, literally to search out and to research in libraries. And I found no books, no literature, just pieces of a vision in a sense. And but I actually, in 1982, 10 years later, my husband said to me, there was a murder in the community up in Sharon Hill, and it was a woman whose daughter had been murdered. And he said, Wanda, why don't you go and talk to her? You could help her.
Literally meaning knock on the door.
Knock on the door.
Introduce yourself.
Introduce myself. And offer her my support.
Did you do that?
I didn't want to, but out of respect for him as the pastor of our church, I did. And I went, and she was so glad to see me. I just said to her, hi, I'm Reverend Wanda Jenkins. My husband is the pastor of the church. And I know your daughter was murdered a couple of weeks ago. And now that everybody's gone, I know it can be a little lonely. If you ever want to talk, I'm available. And she said, come in. And I said, well, let me share a story with you first so you can understand why I'm here. And I told her about my mother's death and the confusion around it and the undue suffering that you go through. And it was the first time she had met someone who was also a survivor.
I'm still stuck in this, I guess, situation at the morgue, because what you're seeing there mm-hmm. is people coming through, identifying a loved one,
mm-hmm.
identifying a dead body. They're there. You're there. What can you offer someone under those extreme circumstances?
Well, the same thing I offered her that day, my presence. My presence and my peace. There isn't anything else I can really give them. The first thing I give them is my presence. And when I say I give them my presence, being there is a real important thing. Being able to know that you're not alone. Because the families who come together, it may be a lot of them when they come in, they're all suffering from the same loss and sorrow. And so they really can't help each other. So they need someone's presence who is not involved, who can ferret out the confusion and help them to understand what it is they're going through.
I know you can't generalize, but under those circumstances, what do people want? Do they want information? Do they want someone to hold their hand? Do they want someone to cry with them? Do they want somebody to figure out how to arrange a funeral?
Yes, all of the above. When families come there, what you have to know is that this is a very confusing time. This is the worst journey of their life. They have to come to the city morgue, and because someone they love has been murdered. And when they don't know what to expect. They just know that they're coming there to identify a body. And everybody's focus is on Quincy. They expect that they're going to walk in, they're going to pull out a drawer, and they're going to see their loved one. That's not the way it is. It's a computer. It's a computer-generated image of the person. It's a picture.
So they're shown a picture.
Right. They don't see a body. Number one, the body is evidence, so they can't touch it. So it's not like it used to be. The body's not brought to you. You go into a sterile room with a monitor, a desk, and three chairs, one behind and two in front. They want two people. You fill out the information for the death certificate, then they show you a picture, and you verify that this is your loved one.
Do you think, and again, this might be hard to generalize, but do you think that people do want to see a body?
Yes.
That they want to see evidence that this person
in some
is
cases,
right there?
In some cases, they do want to see a body. And they'll ask, but they explain to them why they can't do this. Some families are insistent, and they will take them down and let them look through a window like that over there at the body, but they still cannot touch the body. They still cannot. And so it's really best that they just see the picture. In some situations, it's best. It depends on where you are in the United States. But here in Philadelphia, that's the way it's done. What we do is we go out to the family prior to that, and we let them know what's going to happen. You know, I say my name is Wanda Jenkins, or whoever in our staff does it. We tell them that an investigator will be up to see them momentarily, that they're going to go in this room, and if they have the social security number of the person, we let them know all the things that they need so they don't have to rumble through their purse or pockets trying to find information. So what we're really trying to do is reduce the stress associated with the experience so that it really frees the person up to mourn the loss. And we tell them that information, and then we let them know, when you're completed, we have some information for you that may be valuable, and we'll come and get you and take you in our office. And then at that point, we find out, we do our intake, and in the intake, we find out, does this person need insurance, or do they have insurance? And if they don't, we tell them about crime victim compensation at that point.
Well, we're going to take a very short break, and then we'll talk some more. And my guest on Fresh Air today is Reverend Wanda Henry Jenkins. She's the founder and executive director of the Grief Assistance Program, which is headquartered at the Philadelphia Medical Examiner's Office. And she is an authority on the bereavement process for families of murder victims. We'll be back after a very short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Reverend Wanda Henry Jenkins, and we're talking about her work with families who are coping with the aftermath of homicide. I'm thinking for a parent, and I guess this is talking about a child who has been murdered. I don't think there's any greater tragedy or any greater fear than thinking that the child that you borned has gotten murdered. And the sense of responsibility, the feeling that I must, it's my job as a parent to try to protect them from this world. Do parents ever recover from that?
Well, I must be honest with you and tell you that one of the things I don't support is grief competition, and that my grief is greater than your grief. If a parent loses a child, the area of they feel guilty because they feel I should have protected my child, I should have been there for them, that's their feeling of protection. If a child loses a parent to murder, if my parent can be murdered, then what happens to me? That's their level of protection. If a sibling has been murdered, if my sibling can get killed, I can get killed because that's me. For me, the way I feel is that murder is not, death is not something you get over. You work through it and you learn to live with it. And I don't care whether you're a parent, a child, a sibling, a best friend, a fiance. If someone you love is murdered, every single emotion and feeling that comes into that situation is going to hit you. And the last thing that families or survivors of murder victims need to do is to polarize themselves apart from one another with my grief is greater than yours. No, my grief is my grief. That's all.
Have you ever worked with convicted murderers in prisons? So much of your focus is on the grieving process for the family. And I wonder whether you've ever taken that information or the experiences that you have gotten from other families and taken them inside the prison.
As a matter of fact, I have been invited to go with this group called VORP, Victims Offender Reconciliation Program, out to Greaterford to speak to some prisoners and to go as a surrogate victim. I took two other people with me. Because what I wanted to know is if this was done, would this in some way help people who had non-resolved murders to heal, to close that hole in their heart? That was what I wanted to know. Because I actually, that was one of the pieces that closed for me. When a guy called me after a radio program I was on, who was a murderer. And for 6 months we talked before his release. And that was part, I know God just set it up so I could have that peace in my life. I never met the murderer of my mother, but I met this guy. And I would have never talked to him under other conditions except that he heard me on the radio and got the agency number and called me. And it was just a good experience for me. So at Greaterford, when I went to Greaterford, I was very clear that I was there to tell them what their crime had done. And so clear that one of the murderers there said to me, he says, well, you don't have any compassion for us. I said, no, I have compassion for you, but I want you to be clear. I want to clarify for you what your crime has done. I said, because one of the things I told him is I didn't believe in, what do you call it, commutation of sentences, pardons, and all of that kind of stuff, that if you earn your way out of prison, I would do nothing to stop you. But I would never help you get out if you were a murderer under any conditions. But that if you earned your way out and got out, that my only feeling was that when you came back into society, you should do everything to promote nonviolence.
You mentioned the fact that after doing a radio show, a murderer contacted you and you carried on a kind of a conversation for some 6 months, I guess, before he was released.
Right.
How did that actually heal you? How was it that through this man, you were able to put what happened to your mother into some kind of context, I guess, that you could live with more easily?
Well, I don't think I even realized, because at that point, that's when I was helping other families. But when he called and I realized where he was, I remember the first thing I thought is, why is this guy calling me? And as a Christian and as a very spiritual person, I never take anything for granted. And I just really felt, okay, God, you're doing this thing. So what is the purpose? I'm not going to walk away from this. I'm going to talk to this guy. So over the 6 months, we maybe talked once a month, about once or twice a month at the most. And we would talk maybe a half hour or so. But we would talk about how I felt about murderers, how he felt about what he had done. And what happened is that I began to see something. And that was that, did all murderers run alike? That they really weren't, you couldn't just lump them like you couldn't lump all survivors? And I began to see his humanity.
That surprised you?
Yeah, sure it did. When I saw his humanity, I realized in a sense that, I guess there, but for the grace of God, go I could have been in his situation, lived his life, and done the same thing. And even if I had, I would want to be forgiven. And he told me one day, he said, Wanda, one of the things I want to tell you is that when I went in the store that day and I killed that man, I did not go in there to kill him. It happened. He said, and more than likely, that's how it was with your mother. It happened. And, you know, and I really felt like, in a sense, God was saying, it happened. And now you've got to move on from it. And when I realized that, you know, I said, well, I want to tell you that as a victim, that I forgive you for what you've done. But before I said that, he said, I want to apologize to you for what that murderer did. He said, because that was really me. You know, and I mean, of course, he's in New Jersey. He wasn't in Chicago. He wasn't the murderer, but he represented the murderer for me. And in his apology, which I accepted, and gave my forgiveness, it was just a piece of my life that was closed off, that I didn't even know needed to be closed off, but it was.
How do you remember your mother's birthdays or special events that happened in her life, and how do you help other families of murder victims remember the good stuff?
I call it celebration of life. Now, some people have what they call memorial services where they light candles. I don't want any part of that because I think that's nice, but it's like it's a memorial service, and a memorial service is a funeral. That's what it is. It's a funeral without the body present, tears and all of that. And it's not a matter of me being in denial. I know the person is dead, but we're not made to hurt forever. So I celebrate like this now. I encourage people to do whatever it is that makes them feel good. Whatever it is that encourages them, I call it reconciliation, where you reconcile it, but you begin, you want to take opportunities to remember the intangible gifts that you received from the person who is now dead, murdered, but dead. And what I do is on her day of her death and the day of her birth, I tell my children historical things about their grandmother so that they grow up knowing their grandmother, just the same way they know Abraham Lincoln or John Kennedy. And I guess I would say that the most intangible gift that my mother's given me and my father was their concern for the community and for other people. She was a nurse. She always cared for other people. And I think I'm carrying on her legacy.
Wanda Henry Jenkins is the founder and executive director of the Grief Assistance Program, which is headquartered at the Philadelphia Medical Examiner's Office. I'm Marty Moscowane, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, emotional insomnia and other writers' dilemmas. We talk with novelist Michael Chabon about his new novel, Wonder Boys. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews The Romantic Generation, a new recording by pianist Charles Rosen. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. North Carolina Senator Jesse Helms is trying to cut funding for a program that provides care and treatment for AIDS patients. UPI's Diane Kepley prepared this report.
The conservative North Carolina senator has told the New York Times money for the Ryan White Care Act should be reduced significantly because it is the, quote, deliberate, disgusting, revolting conduct of homosexuals that is the cause of their disease. Helms also argues AIDS is only the ninth leading cause of death in America, but accounts for more federal funding than other more deadly diseases. Federal health records do not support the claim. The Centers for Disease Control says AIDS is the leading cause of death among men and women between the ages of 25 and 44. Public Health Service figures also show both heart disease and cancer treatment account for more federal funding than AIDS. Even though there is broad congressional support for the AIDS funding measure, it has stalled in both the House and the Senate. Diane Kepley, Washington.
Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin says he's worried about congressional hearings into the raid on the Branch Davidian compound in Waco, Texas. Rubin gave a letter to journalists saying he fears the hearings might become a forum to break down public support for federal firearms laws. He says that could happen by undermining public confidence in federal law enforcement officers. Rubin also says the joint hearings by the House Judiciary and Government Reform and Oversight Committees, quote, can't be understood properly outside the context of the Oklahoma City bombing. Rubin says federal law enforcement officers are not the real threat to American citizens. The United Nations is holding a three-day conference in Geneva looking for ways to address the problem of landmines around the world. The UN estimates there are more than 100 million landmines around the world. Ambassador Thomas McNamara, head of the conference, says thousands of people are injured each year.
Nations around the world have begun to recognize that that this crisis has to be brought under control. And we were instrumental, the United States government, that is, in urging the United Nations to call this conference and to get other countries to try and come here to discuss the problem, to set up a special fund, United Nations Voluntary Trust Fund, for the assistance of mine clearance.
McNamara says the United States, France, and Belgium are urging other countries to stop exporting landmines and give the international community the chance to clean up the leftover ones. A decorated Vietnam veteran has surrendered on a decommissioned aircraft carrier in South Carolina. Charleston police say Jimmy Jordan gave up today about 30 hours after he went aboard the Yorktown just outside the city. Jordan surrendered shortly after a friend of his was called to the scene. Stock prices closed at a record high today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 30 points to close above the 4,600 mark for the first time, 4,615. Trading was very heavy. This is NPR News. Florida Governor Lawton Chiles has been hospitalized after awakening today with symptoms indicating he is at risk of suffering a stroke. Chiles was taken to Tallahassee Memorial Regional Medical Center before dawn with slurred speech, unsteady coordination, and weakness. Doctors say he's now in stable condition. A spokesman says the symptoms indicated Chiles had a temporary decrease of blood flow to the brain. Doctors say people who suffer such an attack are at very high risk of having a subsequent stroke. Chiles has been advised to remain in the hospital for several days of testing. A new survey of U.S. immigrants finds they have mixed feelings about their new country. The immigrants were mostly positive about the United States, but they said they questioned American moral values and they were worried about illegal immigration. NPR's Laura Kanoy has details.
The survey was conducted by USA Today, CNN, and the Gallup Organization. Pollsters only interviewed English-speaking immigrants, and many of those questioned supported strict measures against illegal immigration. Nearly two-thirds of respondents favored a national identity card to distinguish them from people here illegally. And one-third said illegal immigrants should not receive public services like schools and health care. The immigrants said the United States was full of economic opportunity for themselves and their children. Almost all said that people who work hard can get ahead in the U.S., and nearly three-quarters preferred this country to their homeland. The immigrants were critical of American moral values, and half said they didn't feel as safe in the U.S. as in their native country. This is Laura Kanoy in Washington.
The Commerce Department says some meteorological work done now by the National Weather Service will be transferred to private meteorological services on October 1st. The agency estimates a yearly savings of more than $3 million. Some transferred services include the Agricultural Weather Report and the National Weather Summary. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. When Michael Chabon burst on the literary scene a few years ago, he was hailed as an exciting new talent, a bona fide member of the so-called Brat Pack of 20-something writers. The novel that caused so much stir, The Mysteries of Pittsburgh, was a three-month bestseller on the New York Times list. People magazine wanted to profile Chabon in their 50 Most Beautiful People edition. He turned them down. The success of his first novel landed a big advance for the next one. He's set to work on a new novel called Fountain City, but 5 years and 1,500 pages later, he came to a standstill. So he started a new novel about an aging professor named Grady Tripp, whose masterwork is still unfinished at 2,000-plus pages. Chabon was able to finish this one. It's called Wonder Boys. I spoke with Michael Chabon about writing and about the frustration of trying to finish an uncompleted book.
Yeah, I couldn't bring it in for a landing. I went through six or five complete drafts of that book and had started a sixth when I finally abandoned it. And I worked on it for a little over 5 years. It was, in a lot of ways, one of the worst things that's ever happened to me in terms of, I really felt that I had lost my way. The problem was simply that I think I just bit off more than I could chew. Mm-hmm. It was a big book. It had a lot of characters, many plot strands, and it got away from me, and I could never tie them all together in a way that I was satisfied with.
Well, did you think you had to come in with something even greater than The Mysteries of Pittsburgh?
No, I don't really think so, because the idea that I started with on that book was very small, and I originally just planned to write a really short little book, and I almost thought that was the way I was going to kind of short-circuit whatever expectation game there might be by doing something that was perversely slight in a way and so that I didn't try to do too much. But somehow it just grew. I got, like Topsy, I just got involved in all these elements I was loading into the book, and it just kept... I mean, the novel is very deceptive in that it tricks you into thinking that it can hold just about anything. And there are plenty of writers, I shouldn't say plenty, there are some writers from Cervantes to Nabokov to Thomas Pynchon who have managed to shovel all kinds of strange things into a book and gotten it to stick together more or less. And if you read books like that, and I did read some of those kind of sort of steamer trunk kind of novels when I was working on Fountain City, and I think it tricked me into thinking I was ready to do the same thing, and I really wasn't. Maybe someday I will be.
Well, I want to have you read from the beginning couple of pages of your new novel, and you were just talking about the difficulty of as you say, bringing us a manuscript in for a landing.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you can set this up for us and read a section for
okay.
us,
okay. This is Grady talking about his book, Wonder Boys. This meditation of his is prompted by the arrival at the beginning of the book of his editor and oldest and best friend, Terry Crabtree, who has been very patient with Grady. He's waited about 7 years and has not really pestered Grady too much about this book, although he personally, Terry, has a lot riding on it. And his own editorial career has come to ruin pretty much, and in a way partly because of Grady. He spent a lot of money on this book of Grady's, and Grady has yet to deliver it. So he's come to Pittsburgh ostensibly to attend a writer's conference, but really to sort of check up on this book and see if there's anything there at all that can possibly be salvaged. So as Grady picks Terry up at the airport in Pittsburgh where the book takes place, this is what he thinks. Crabtree asks him how the book's going, and Grady says, "It's fine." He was talking about my fourth novel, or what purported to be my fourth novel, Wonder Boys, which I had promised to Bartizan during the early stages of the previous presidential administration. My third novel, The Land Downstairs, had won a Penn Award and, at 12,000 copies, sold twice as well as both its predecessors combined. And in its aftermath, Crabtree and his bosses at Bartizan had felt sanguine enough about my imminent attainment to the status of, at the least, cult favorite, to advance me a ridiculous sum of money in exchange for nothing more than a fatuous smile from the thunderstruck author and a title invented out of air and brain sparkle while pissing into the aluminum trough of a men's room at Three Rivers Stadium. Luckily for me, an absolutely superb idea for a novel soon followed. Three brothers in a haunted Pennsylvania small town are born, grow up, and die. And I'd started to work on it at once and had been diligently hacking away at the thing ever since. Motivation, inspiration were not the problem. On the contrary, I was always cheerful and workmanlike at the typewriter and had never suffered from what's called writer's block. I didn't believe in it. The problem, if anything, was precisely the opposite. I had too much to write. Too many fine and miserable buildings to construct, and streets to name, and clock towers to set chiming. Too many characters to raise up from the dirt like flowers whose petals I peeled down to the intricate, frail organs within. Too many terrible genetic and fiduciary secrets to dig up and bury and dig up again. Too many divorces to grant. Heirs to disinherit, trysts to arrange, letters to misdirect into evil hands, innocent children to slay with rheumatic fever, women to leave unfulfilled and hopeless, men to drive to adultery and theft, fires to ignite at the hearts of ancient houses. It was about a single family, and it stood, as of that morning, at 2,611 pages, each of them revised and rewritten a half dozen times. And yet, for all of those years and all of those words expended in charting the eccentric paths of my characters through the violent blue heavens I had set them to cross, they had not even reached their zeniths. I was nowhere near the end.
And that's our guest, Michael Chabon, reading from his novel, Wonder Boys. Grady says this is he doesn't have writer's block, that he's cheerful at his typewriter.
Yes.
But isn't this also writer's block? I mean, this inability to discard all this, as you say, all this too much stuff.
Right. Yes. In a way, it's a block of a different thing, I suppose. It's not the sort of flow of language that's blocked so much as the organizational impulse or something like that. And a lot of what doing... making art is, as Stephen Sondheim said, it's putting things together. And so if you can't figure out the right way to put things together, it doesn't really matter how many things you've managed to generate.
More from writer Michael Chabon after a short break. His new novel is called Wonder Boys. This is Fresh Air. My guest is novelist Michael Chabon, whose latest book is called Wonder Boys. There's a reference in Wonder Boys to midnight disease, and you describe it as a kind of emotional insomnia. What is that?
That's Grady's term for the condition of being a writer that he likes to view in a way metaphorically, but not entirely metaphorically, as kind of as a malady. It's composed mostly of a feeling of alienation from oneself, from one's life, and also from other people, that he compares to the feeling of an insomniac lying awake in bed at night, knowing that everyone else around him is sound asleep and dreaming, and that feeling of a gulf between you and other people, and a sense that you are, and there's a sense, I am an insomniac myself, so I know, yes, and I know from reading other literary insomniacs work that you do, there is a strangely privileged feeling to it at the same time that it's a miserable and suffering kind of experience. You have a sense that, I don't know, people, there are people who, you know, practice violin when they can't sleep at night, that there's, you've been given this extra time, and at the same time it's a burden on you. There's something of the same thing happens when you write for a long time. This alienation comes about, I think, and Grady definitely believes, because you are trying so hard, at first by reminding yourself, and then eventually just by automatic reaction, to observe and to remember and to notice and record and all of those things you need to do, that if you're doing all that, then you aren't really quite living. You're not quite experiencing what's going on around you directly the way people who aren't so caught up in trying to remember things are.
Do you labor over words when you write?
Yes. I write on a computer, so it's very conducive to rewriting. And I but it's not sort of blind rewriting, just trying stuff over and over again until it looks okay. I write when it's going well, with a kind of rhythm in my mind, in my inner ear, that guides me to put sentences together in a certain way. And often I know I don't quite have the words right, or I'm using lazy language, or the word choice is a little off, but the rhythm is right, and I leave it like that, and then I'll go back and fix it and try to make the language better, but always trying to stick to that original rhythm that I heard for the sentence.
When your first book came out, The Mysteries of Pittsburgh, you were called a gay writer because you had gay characters.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel that you had to defend yourself against this description of yourself?
No, not at all. I felt, I don't know, I didn't really feel all that much of anything except a little surprised that there could be such sort of shoddy journalistic practice by a magazine as big as Newsweek,
right,
which was kind of the main culprit for this. But then I did get a little worried and disturbed when I learned afterward that there was apparently, hopefully, a small portion of the gay community that was upset because they felt that I had been marketed as a gay writer deliberately by my publisher as a way of sort of roping in unsuspecting gay readers into, you know, reading the works of a straight writer, God forbid. So,
well, is this related to this whole idea that there are youthful writers and there are feminist writers and there are gay writers and that there are these categories, whether it's agents or critics or readers try to stuff people into?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I think so. It's a kind of vast conspiracy between the marketing people and the critics and readers and bookstores and maybe just our entire our society right now is very much into categorizing and labeling and pigeonholing, and it doesn't ever feel good to be pigeonholed.
Another quote, and this is that one of your earliest inspirations was Henry Miller. The quote is that I wanted to go to Paris, have a lot of sex, and write about it.
Yeah.
Indeed, did you say that?
Yes, he was kind of the first lifestyle writer for me. I mean, there are writers that one admires more for their lifestyles than for their writing, and I think Henry Miller's probably the ultimate example of that. Although when I first started reading him, I thought he was a great writer. I now have a hard time getting through even one of his paragraphs. But it was always really about this idea of just being this complete reckless, amoral.
Right.
You know, when you're
17
years old.
Did you have a chapter in your life where you tried that?
By the time I got to Paris, finally, I was older and had started to already begin to feel kind of the moral pangs and consequences of my bad behavior, and it was kind of too late for all that.
So where is the manuscript, the 1,500 pages, the second novel that was supposed to be called The Fountain? Do you still have it?
Yeah, it's in two Kinko's boxes in the closet in my office, and there it will lie forever.
Never to see the light of day?
No.
Mm-mm. But you're going to keep it?
Yeah, I'm going to keep it.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Well,
who knows?
I don't like to throw anything away.
Okay. That's novelist Michael Chabon, author of Wonder Boys. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer has joined us now to tell us about some of the stories they'll be covering on All Things Considered. Linda, what do you have for us?
Marty, we're looking at the U.S. and China, our relations with that country, the possibility of missiles being sold to Pakistan. We'll talk about human rights and we'll see what Pakistan wants to do with those missiles. Also, kids whose parents have AIDS, children who are about to be orphans, the growing controversy on how to separate, how to share among the states, block grants on for Medicare. We'll also be talking to some Serbs in Sarajevo on why they've stayed despite the Serb bombardment and about the Swiss who are changing the standards for chocolate.
Thanks, Linda. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says that nobody writes about music more insightfully than pianist Charles Rosen. What's even more unusual is that no one plays the music he writes about better either. Rosen has a new book and a new recording, and Lloyd has been looking forward to both of them.
As a pianist, Charles Rosen is probably best known for playing 20th century music, Stravinsky, Boulez, Elliot Carter. But in some circles, he's even better known as a writer than as a performer. His National Book Award-winning The Classical Style is a landmark in the understanding of the music of Haydn, Mozart, and Beethoven, how the structure of classical music is essentially dramatic. Rosen's new book, The Romantic Generation, is a 700-page volume that grew out of his brilliant Charles Eliot Norton lectures at Harvard. These dealt with the extraordinary ways the music of the Romantic period, especially Chopin, Schumann, Berlioz, and Liszt, broke from the classical tradition by giving the texture of sound itself an increasingly significant role in the way music was conceived. Pasted to the inside of the book is a CD on which Rosen plays his own musical footnotes. Three of these examples come from his new recording on Music Masters, also called The Romantic Generation. That's the dramatic opening of Liszt's Reminiscences of Don Juan, his extraordinary transformation for the piano of themes from Mozart's Don Giovanni. It's a chilling and mind-bogglingly difficult romantic phantasmagoria that interweaves three of the major subjects of the opera: pleasure, sexual desire, not necessarily the same thing as pleasure, and hell. I'm especially tickled by Rosen's teasing way with Liszt's variations on the duet in which Don Giovanni tries to seduce the all-too-eager Zerlina. The greatest work on Rosen's recording is Schumann's autobiographical David's Bündlertänze, Dances of the League of David, that is, the biblical David in his fight against the Philistines. Schumann created two characters, Eusebius and Florestan, to express the two opposite sides of his own personality, the introvert and the extrovert. David's Bündlertänze consists of 18 short dances, a series of highly calculated yet surprising contrasts between Eusebius and Florestan. Schumann builds the small sections into a large and complex unity. The second section, for example, is a lovely dance marked inward. Later, Schumann interrupts the next-to-last section, which he marks as if from far away, with the heartbreaking memory of that earlier dance. Rosen's special triumph is his uncanny instinct for rhythm. Everything dances. He gives the whole work a relentless sense of inevitability. There isn't an empty or automatic or pedantic moment on this entire album. That's saying a lot for either a pianist or a music professor.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed The Romantic Generation, a new recording by pianist Charles Rosen on the Music Masters label. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu and Kathy Wolf. And we welcome back Sue Weinstein. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Research assistants from Becky Cohen. Roberta Sharrock directed today's show. For Terry Gross, I'm Artie Moss-Cohen.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.